Hey, welcome back. This is part two of episode 7 of the Baseball Perspectives Milwaukee podcast. And in this week, we're conversation with Ryan Connor, this time about specific hitters and what their swings look like. Are there any current hitters that are going direct bat to ball in major leagues?
One that drove me nuts for years was Gene Segura.
Yep.
When he went to Arizona, actually, he did some to fix this. So some of Gene Segura's improvement, in my opinion, is actually real.
Okay.
He made an adjustment. It was kind of the Keon Broxton adjustment, if we'll get onto that later, where he brought his hands down a little bit. And guys with their hands really high, if they don't get them back down kind of near their armpit area, are just going to naturally struggle to get on plane, get behind the ball, just because of the way the angles are going to work. So Gene was a guy who was very, high. He was kind of up by his head, and he didn't load them down kind of into that armpit chest area where it's just going to be easy to turn the barrel over into the zone. Mm. And so, I mean, Gene Segura was the king of the ground ball to the second baseman.
Right. Yeah.
He hit so many of those.
Yeah.
And you see it this year. I mean, his power went up. Part of it's going to Chase Field, which is a little bit better than Miller Park. Miller Park's definitely not a bad hitter's park, so that doesn't explain everything.
Mm.
And but you saw power numbers go up for him. I wouldn't be surprised if we were able to track this. This is one thing I would like to see tracked a little bit better with some of the StatCast data. I know it's going to be pretty hard because it's of everything that they're trying to cover, but it is the swing angles of the players and just comparing the average bat path, basically.
Actually, since you brought it up, let's go on and talk about Keon Broxton. So what was the changes he made with the swing?
Okay, the biggest thing is he just lowered his hands in the start, and he really, really lowered them. Most guys, when they lower them, they go, from their ear or the top of their head down to their shoulder.
Now you're talking about lower when it, like in the
when he starts
when you start, not like a hitch or something, right?
Yep. No, it was not just in the start, because where you start, is going to usually influence where you end up when you're in the process of loading. The load isn't like one movement, it's a process.
Mm.
And so when guys go through that loading process, it's usually going to be affected by where their hands are. That's why where your hands start ultimately doesn't like matter, but where they end up matters. But where they start is going to affect where they end up.
Mm, gotcha.
So with a guy like Keon, he really, really lowered his hands. Like he starts down, by his belly button at this point. And he comes kind of back up, but you'll see he comes back up into that armpit area, that really good launch spot that you're going to see the best hitters be around.
Well, I'm thinking of low hands with the Brewers. Correct me if I'm wrong, which I'm sure you will many times later. What about Ricky Weeks? He had his hands down pretty low, right?
Yep. Weeks is another guy that was a low hands guy. There were other things in Weeks' swing. A lot of it was just his balance was just really, really weird.
Mm.
And he would kind of get out of his swing. He was also a guy that was kind of falling. Like we've seen like guys like Adrian Beltre be extremely successful with what looked like, unbalanced, awkward swings. But Ricky Weeks, the biggest thing, he would come closed off. It was hard for him to get himself open. And so his hands would be really kind of direct to the ball to try and rush that process. And that's why you'd see, a lot of pop-ups and stuff. And some of it's just, some guys don't have the hand-eye coordination. And that's something you can't really tell objectively. That's something you just kind of figure out over the long period.
Now what about Ryan Braun, though? His hands are, at least they start off, pretty far high.
Yeah, well, biggest thing with Ryan Braun is when you watch it, because his bat is so long, I think he uses a 36 or 37 inch bat, it looks like his hands are like up above his head,
right?
But the thing that always surprises me is when I go to a video, they're actually not that high. They're definitely like higher than the ideal launch zone,
right?
But when Ron loads his hands, he loads his hands down and back, and he gets right into that ideal launch zone. So like I said, like Jose Bautista, another guy, hands start extremely high and get down into a launch zone because his load is very long, so
right,
he can afford to travel that distance.
I mean, that's a great point about, because when I think of stances, I mean, that's where the hands are starting out, because even like Pujols' hands are like way up there, right?
Correct.
When he starts off. But you're saying loading is a process, so it's a matter of where they are when the pitch is starting to be delivered.
Yeah, the longer your loading process is, a guy who has a longer loading process, like a Donaldson, Mookie Betts, Bronze, even though there's not a leg kick there, his loading process is pretty long. He starts himself pretty early.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider like Bautista like picking up his front leg as part of the loading process?
Yep. Okay. Yep. To me, the front leg and the what I call the back shoulder,
mm-hmm.
is going to be like your back elbow kind of through into your what are called like the scap area. Those are going to be intricately related. If you have a lot of hand loading, it's going to probably be easier just for you to time everything up and feel in rhythm if you also incorporate kind of a slow leg kick into that. If you're a guy that doesn't have a lot of movement in your swing, like a Chase Utley, who's extremely still, Chase Utley just starts himself in a good position, and so he doesn't have to have a lot of movement, and so he doesn't have a big leg kick. His load is very simple, and there's not one thing for everybody. It's kind of feeling out what's going to work. A lot of trial and error is involved, but
is that? I mean, when I think of Joey Votto as having a relatively simple load as well. Is that true?
Correct. Yeah, Joey Votto does a lot of kind of weird things. He's one of the guys that chokes up on the bat, which I hate. I hate it when guys choke up on the bat.
Because you just think, just use a shorter bat?
Well, yeah, I mean, just use a shorter bat, or like, I don't understand why in a position where you are more likely to get outside pitches with two strikes, you'd want to make the bat shorter.
Oh, when you say choke up, you don't mean always choking up, but choking up in when you're down in the count?
Yeah, Votto doesn't always choke up really high. He tends to be, I mean, he always is like, from what I've seen, and I've seen a decent amount of Joey Votto, but, you know, he tinkers, you know, a decent amount. He'll start with, you know, slightly choked up, but, I mean, I'm talking like a half an inch off a knob. And some guys, like, they wrap two fingers around the knob, so that's just really personal preference.
Mm-hmm.
But then with two strikes, he'll kind of load himself up, you know, a good inch and a half to show the bat up. Some guys feel they get better barrel control. I just think you're really cutting yourself off at the end, but I'm not going to tell Joey Votto not to do it. If it's really
I was just going to say, we should stay away from criticizing Joey Votto.
No, that's the biggest thing, is if you're successful doing something,
right?
The worst thing a coach can do is tell you to stop doing it.
Right.
It's when failure is presented, and it's time to reflect and be like, okay, what can I fix in my hitting process to, you know, break through that next wall? And with someone like Joey Votto, it's like there really hasn't been a next wall. Like, he's been one of the best hitters in baseball. There's nothing to change there. I mean, the thing is, everything Votto does otherwise is fantastic.
Mm.
I mean, he's very simple, but he gets on plane really well. He covers the entire zone, and his batting eye is just uncanny.
Well, and you can tell from the on-base percentage year after year, right? So, I mean, sorry to jump around between different hitters, but it's really useful as you're talking about different parts of the swing to have player comps in my head, at least, and hopefully the listeners' heads, of being like, oh, okay, I know what you're talking about when you say this because of XYZ player that you know, we've seen quite often. So going back to Broxton, though, so he lowered his hands, which enabled him to get in plane quicker?
Yeah, he basically, by lowering his hands, I'm going to guess, now this is playing a little bit of like hitter psychology, because people make adjustments for all sorts of different reasons.
Okay.
But what I'm going to guess the point was here is he lowers his hands to basically when he brings them up to bring them into a lower position than it was before, which is ultimately what happened. And this was able, so he was in a better launching position. He was a better loaded position, you know, where his hands were more around that kind of between your nipple and your armpit.
Mm.
So he was able to basically turn the barrel over on plane. And that's where turning the barrel over is where your back elbow is going to come down as your front elbow comes up.
Mm.
That's going to basically put the barrel into the zone. And he basically gave himself a significant greater time to hit the ball. And you notice because, like, he still strikes out a lot. And some of it is because he takes a lot of pitches because he also walks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it is also because he's a hitter that tries to do damage on swings. And you saw that with his exit velos, which were extremely strong. His power numbers were extremely strong. And so there's always some give and take with that. And his swing got a little bit more vertical, a little steeper, which is actually, in my opinion, that's good. I think this is the approach that Keon should have. He's an extremely explosive athlete. He's extremely fast. He has a good arm. Basically, everything Keon does is explosive. And
right.
So for him to, you know, want to get rid of the power, I think, or sacrifice a little bit of steepness in the swing would be a poor decision. I think you're just going to have to live with a guy who's probably going to strike out close to 30% of the time, but a guy who's also going to walk a lot and provide you with power and hopefully, you know, what looks like to be near elite defense in center field. I mean, I don't think the second half Keon Broxton was a fluke. I thought that was real, because part of what he did also in lowering his hands is he became less upright as a hitter. And there's very few guys that are extremely upright that do well. One of them, of course, being Ryan Braun, because he has a phenomenal hip hinge. When he lifts his leg, he does. And if you're if any of the listeners are do a lot of deadlifts, I'm sure they've heard a lot about hip hinge. But it's basically where your pelvis is going to slide backwards without you arching your back. And so you're kind of, your butt slides backwards and you actually get a little bit lower. And that's just going to put you, it's going to make it easier for you to hit low pitches and actually going to allow you to utilize the strong muscles of the glutes and the hamstrings in your swing. Keon did a better job of that when he lowered his hands because he was just less upright. So the hip hinge was just easier.
Gotcha.
So you'll see guys that'll be a little bit more hunched over. Jeff Bagwell is one of the guys who, you know, he almost started out in a hip hinge and then just loaded a little bit. And so you'll see guys like that. And that was another thing. Like, that's really where the power really is going to come from. He's able to utilize his hip extension as well as the rotation work, because it's not just a one-way street. You'll have guys that are more upright. It'll be more rotational. Jock Peterson is probably the prominent example. There's not a lot of hip hinge. There's not a lot of hip extension. It's very rotational. Which is fine. I mean, it can work.
Now you're talking about when you say upright. I mean, I'm thinking both the where the hip is, but also how bent the knees are, or are they kind of not related?
The knees are part of it. When hitters try to get themselves lower, they tend to bend at the knees, which doesn't really give us much. The knee bending is basically a comfort thing. Some guys feel more comfortable lower. Some guys feel comfortable really upright, like a Ryan Braun or a Jock Peterson. When it comes to uprightness, I really look at the hips and what you're doing around the pelvic area. Are you sitting into your hips more, being a little bit lower, or are you still more upright and going to be very rotational? Because if you don't sit in your hips, you're just not going to be able to extend your hips. And obviously, because you have to load to unload. And a guy who's going to be more rotational, like a Jock Peterson, is just not going to really use that hip extension. And that doesn't mean you can't have power. It just means you're utilizing a different type of hip action to get your power. And there is a bunch of different sacrifices you can make. And this kind of gets into a really complex thing of, you know, is rotational better? Do you want to get more extension stuff? And it really depends player to player, because certain players physically aren't capable of being as rotational as Jock Peterson is. Like, he can probably throw a medicine ball through a wall. And some guys can't control, you know, their hip hinge, or maybe they're not super strong in their glutes and their hamstrings, so it doesn't make a ton of sense for them to be a guy that relies more on hip extension. And then you get guys like Ryan Braun, who is, you know, a unicorn and does both extremely well.
Now, when you say rotation, do you mean like your hips rotating, that kind of rotation? Okay.
Yep. This is going to be the type of thing where, like you were talking about earlier, where your hips end up, basically rotation is going to be your hips start facing with your hips are going to be orientated straight towards the plate in front of you. And then at the end, they're orientated towards center field or left center field or right center field, depending on how much rotation you have.
Right.
Guys like Jock Peterson are extremely rotational. He really fires his hips, around very hard. And then there's guys who are really more extension based, that maybe don't always orientate themselves, you know, to their left center side, but maybe are a little bit right of center field. And this is all, and pitches have a lot to do with this too, about how much rotation occurs.
Javier Baez seems like, I mean, he ends up on his like knees and stuff sometimes, but Javier Baez, or maybe even, I don't know if Adrian Beltre is rotational.
Yeah, Beltre is kind of another one of those guys that's extremely good at both.
Okay.
But he's also very rotational.
What was the other one? So there's rotational. What does extension mean?
That's where, extension is basically the thrusting of your hips forward.
Okay.
So you have the hip hinge, which takes the pelvis and takes your glutes backwards. So like you're going in to do a deadlift. Or like when you go into a squat, how your hips go backwards. And the extension process is just the undoing of that. It's then coming back forward.
Okay. Now, how does that generate? I mean, I think you mentioned it, but do you have to then rely on your back foot to generate power? Or
Not necessarily, no. Okay. You're not going to necessarily use much really below your knees in terms of, creating power, guys who really want to feel like they drive off their back foot,
mm-hmm.
Or they drive off their back knee, are actually making a mistake. Because a lot of them will cave their knee in and really feel like they're driving off of that.
Mm.
But what they've done there is they've sacrificed the stronger muscles of the hip joint on the outside. Mm. They're going to be able to provide more power. And I mean, there's, if you want, there's places that you can find this on. I recommend going to the eastbayhittingobstruction.com for visuals if you're looking for any of this. Jerry Brewer has written about a lot of it.
Mm.
So I definitely recommend the listeners to go and look at that. If they're really interested in the physiology of it. But the hip extension, you're really just relying more on the glutes and the hamstrings to provide the power. And that doesn't mean you're not rotating. You're still rotating.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a percentage of where you're getting your power from, rotation versus extension. And pretty much everyone is going to get more power from rotation because it's a more violent movement. And
right.
It's more because you have to rotate to get power.
Mm-hmm.
But some guys will get all of it from almost all of it from rotation, like a Jock Peterson, and some guys will utilize both.
Mm, gotcha. And guys who can do both, like Braun and Beltre, you're saying it would depend on the type of pitcher, the type of pitch situation kind of thing, or is it just more of a mixture each time?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Inside pitches are generally you're going to rotate harder to really get your bat around. But generally, like I like to look at it, if they're trying to hit middle pitches, that's really where you're going to see middle or middle down pitches, where you're going to see like their most natural swing.
Mm, gotcha.
And Braun and Beltre are guys that do this both really well.
So let's talk about Chris Carter. And was he a rotational guy? And
Carter was pretty rotational.
Okay.
One thing I've noticed, and because you're kind of categorizing these guys, and not just you, but like myself, we're kind of categorizing them as like rotational, or do they do extension?
Mm-hmm.
It's like really rough, and it's hard to tell without like slapping like nodes on these guys and testing like which muscles are firing when.
Right, right.
Basically, we're trying to take and make data out of something that's a little bit imperfect. But a guy like Carter that I've noticed with rotational guys. Rotational heavy guys, is the swing and misses there a little bit more, and I haven't quite figured out why that is. I'm wondering if it's because they're just coming out of the zone a little bit earlier, and maybe their swing direction is a little bit more pulling out of the zone, whereas extension guys might be able to stay through the zone a little bit better.
Gotcha.
In terms of like where their barrel direction is going, but Chris Carter, part of it too is like when you're just tall, it's harder. To have good barrel control, you see it. Like Giancarlo Stanton's a guy that strikes out a lot. Aaron Judge is a guy that's been strikeout concerns about. Chris Bryant. But just when you get 6'4 and past that, you look at most of those guys are going to run high strikeout rates.
Hmm.
It's just harder to have barrel control. And you look at smaller guys like Altuve. It's just easier to have the David Eckstein. It's just easier to have barrel control because you just have your moving parts are smaller,
mm-hmm.
so they're easier to control. But in that. The bigger guys usually have more power, so there's a trade-off in both ways. And part of it is Chris Carter would jam himself up. He was a guy that sequenced not great. He was, for being a big guy, he was actually kind of hands to the ball, which I found to be just a really odd combination. And you actually do see this because small guys that are hands to the ball, it's very hard for them to get to the majors because they'll get the bat knocked out of their hand.
Mm.
They won't be able to create bat speed. But you'll see some bigger guys that are not great, but they have the power there. They have the raw strength. And they'll be a little bit more bat directed to ball. Now, nobody at the major league level is like aggressively like your JV guy hitting ground ball after ground ball to second base. But his barrel plane is just not great. He's strong as hell. And that masks, a lot of swing problems. Just being big and strong can mask a lot of swing problems.
Right.
But, he's definitely a guy, like, if I was trying to, tell somebody to build a swing, I wouldn't use Chris Carter's.
So that brings me to a non-scouting question, which is what did you think about the non-tendering then, based on what your analysis is like, you were okay with it?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. I mean, it's not that much money. It was probably going to be somewhere between $8 and $10 million to retain him.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest thing that I saw is like, as someone who plays first base, Chris Carter is an abomination to first base.
Really?
He is legitimately the worst first baseman I've watched, and I watched Prince Fielder
and Unieski Betancourt play first base also.
Chris Carter this isn't a surprise at the major league level. He's not a great athlete.
Mm-hmm.
Slow. His arm is bad, which is fine. A lot of first basemen are slow and, have bad arms and stuff. So he's not, going to get by with his athleticism, but mm-hmm. his technique at first base is just atrocious. He's terrible at picking balls. His footwork is really terrible around the base. He doesn't set himself up well. And part of it's just because I think he's just kind of like a slower person. And he did a lot of DHing. Mm. First base is not, it's a relatively easy position to play athletically. But you'll see good guys that are, it's really about just utilizing proper techniques and stuff at first base. But I mean, he's a slightly above average league average hitter. He's a first base DH. He really should be a DH. He's a terrible first baseman. And we at this point we know what Chris Carter is. Like,
right.
Chris Carter basically had the best season Chris Carter's gonna have last year.
Yeah.
And was worth, I don't even think he was worth 2 wins by any of the WAR metrics.
No. Right.
And I think he was anywhere between, I think like one of them had him close to a half a win, and I think the best one had him at like 1.7-ish
mm-hmm.
off the top of my head. And so there's really there's no waiting for Chris Carter's upside. It's kind of like this is what he is. Chris Carter's not a guy that's gonna be able to control big movements probably, so there's not really gonna be much of a hitting adjustment you're gonna be able to make with him. And he's a terrible first baseman. And at least with a guy like Thames, while I don't love Thames' swing, there's upside there just because of what we don't know. And I mean, he got bigger and way stronger in Korea.
Yeah, so I did want to ask you before we move on to breaking down Thames' swing. It is kind of interesting. So first of all, on Chris Carter, my thoughts were I was definitely disappointed that the non-tendering happened, but then with the Thames signing, it kind of fell into place. And now that I know more about his swing from you, but just generally, not that he was considered a good first baseman anyway. It's kind of a relief to maybe see somebody like Thames who can only be better than Chris Carter at first base.
Yeah,
but
it is actually difficult to be
to be
just
worse.
From like a scouting perspective. Now I know first base defense data wise is like really murky.
Right,
it's
right.
Kind of, we don't really know. Like we know colloquially who, or like not colloquially, but like anecdotally, sorry, who the good first basemen are mm-hmm. defensively. Like Joey Votto is really good.
Yeah, Paul Goldschmidt.
Doug Mankiewicz was amazing defensively.
Right.
And we know that like Prince Fielder is bad, and we know that Mark right. Trumbo can play literally no positions, and that Chris Carter's not good. But like Chris Carter, just from watching him, was the worst first baseman I've seen at the professional level.
But about Thames and his scouting his batting, right? But mm-hmm. it seems like the Brewers scouted him entirely through video, and we were just talking earlier about how video, especially like slow motion video, really breaking it down is super super useful. But do you lose anything if you've never seen none of the scouts had seen him in person?
I mean, I guess you probably lose something. I mean, it's a matter of prioritizing your resources. I guess the Brewers now have a scout, whose sole job is to monitor Asia. So I don't know if that's like Japan, Korea, what else that really entails. But
right,
days ago, but if they scouted him solely through video,
right, yeah,
you miss out maybe on you don't see him walking. It's all the old cliches, you don't get to see his mental makeup, you don't get to see how he preps himself for his plate appearances, what he's like with his teammates, all that kind of cliche stuff that mm-hmm. that goes into the makeup thing, which I'm very hesitant to slap makeup grades or makeup analysis on anyone really, because
right.
people from the outside just don't know how really what's going on the inside unless they're getting information from the inside, and even that information can be biased. So I think really scouting through video, if anything, you actually eliminate some of your own biases that you're going to have at the ballpark. Like I said before, I think it's extremely difficult to properly analyze a swing in real time.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean you can't, and very well-trained eyes can,
mm-hmm.
but like the trouble with the curve video where he's like, oh, this kid, can't hit a curveball because he saw him, he had a weird hitch in his swing. Like, that's not how this actually works. Plenty of guys have things that look like hitches that aren't really hitches. and plenty of guys have what look like smooth swings, but they have these really fatal flaws when you look at it through video, like their plane is really bad, or their hands go way too early, or they can't hit low balls because they don't tip themselves properly. You know, there's a lot of things that you can see on video that you can't see in live time, but that doesn't mean, even with video, that you shouldn't watch things in live time, because that really good, that can give you some context too. So I think it's, you know,
so what's Thames' swing like?
Honestly, the Chris Carter and Eric Thames thing, he's another guy that kind of likes to leverage with his hands and get his hands kind of out in front of him a little earlier than his ideal. That doesn't mean that he's hopeless, though. There's a lot of guys that, even at the major league level, that do that. I don't think Eric Thames is going to come here and hit 45 home runs and have a 380 on base percentage or anything like that. He's not going to be an elite first baseman, just from what I've seen on video. It's been hard to find good Eric Thames video of anything but him hitting home runs.
Right, exactly.
He hasn't changed a whole lot since going to Korea. It looks like he has started his hands a little bit lower than he did. So that might be helping him get on plane. It's hard also to really get like high quality video that stays together well and stays in focus when you put it into a more slow motion video program. So I'm kind of working with a third of the data, I guess, that I really like.
Right,
but
for sure.
The biggest thing you notice is the dude is just ungodly strong. This is a massive muscular human that whose intent is to do damage. So really, like, approach wise you're probably going to see an approach like a Chris Carter, where it's going to be, I'm going to try and muscle up and hit the ball out of the ballpark, which can work. I mean, there's guys that have been successful,
and I wonder how much coaches will want to coach him compared to other players that are on the 25-man roster, because with most players, unless you worked with them as in the minor leagues, I mean, by the time they're in the majors, they have, you know, pretty much most things figured out, you'd think, right? Whereas Eric Thames was in Korea for a while. Is this something where the coaches say, all right, well, in the majors, your swing should be a little bit different?
I think something with Thames, I think the biggest thing is when you reach that point, you have taken so many swings that your body has, you know, you're basically, hitting becomes unconscious. You don't think about doing anything. You just do it because your body has done it, you know, at that point, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe even so many times over, that your body's just done the same action over and over. And everything that you've done since you were five until then, like, has just ingrained muscle memory into your body. So at the major league level, it's extremely difficult to do what Josh Donaldson did and totally change everything.
Right.
To do what Jose Bautista did and change everything. That requires an uncanny amount of self-awareness to realize there's actually a problem, because these are incredibly prideful people. And then also, you know, the willingness to go through something that is probably initially, like, just in the off season, going to feel weird and successful, because you're going to feel weird and it's going to be uncomfortable, and to go through that process. So at the major league level, if they do anything to Thames, I'm sure it'll be really small. They won't want to overload him, because he'll be coming back into the major leagues. He'll have to, you know, get readjusted to major league pitching, because the pitching in Korea, just from what I watched from him, is really poor. Like, the ballparks are small, but the pitching there is not good. So it's definitely, as everyone knows, the KBO is a huge hitter's league, and he was really able to take advantage of that by being, you know, bigger and stronger than a lot of guys.
Right.
But as we've seen, you know, some guys come over from the KBO and are successful. Jung Ho Gong was successful, even though now he's in trouble again. And Byung Ho Park for the Twins, which is my roommate's a Twins fan, and was asking me about that. I was like, Park's swing looks pretty good, but, you know, sometimes, like, guys just from a neurological reaction level just can't hit major league pitching. And that's part of the thing too, is, like, it's not just about your swing. Like, can you process the information and make a decision and, you know, put your body in the position to hit the ball? And some guys, just no matter what they do, will just not ever be physically able to do that.
Okay. Ryan, let's close out this long episode, which was super informative, but let me close it out with one of my favorite players, Domingo Santana. And even though he hasn't produced as much, I'm still holding out hope for him. What does his swing look like?
Well, first of all, the good on Santana. We saw this early in the season. The exit velos are strong. This is a guy that has elite bat speed. and is a very big and strong man. He's a guy that utilizes hip hinge very well. He is a guy that is really a hip extension type hitter. Downsides, he's a guy that uses the hands a little bit earlier than you'd like to create bat speed. His bat's just not in the zone for a long period of time. The hips and torso kind of move together as one. I'm not sure if that's a flexibility issue. I think it's more likely to be a sequencing issue. These guys are all elite athletes. But you'd be surprised at some of the instabilities that they have.
Normally you want your hips out first and then the torso kind of thing?
Yep, yeah. And it's tight. Like it's going to be difficult for people to notice in real time. But you notice it in a frame-by-frame. Guys are going to land with their hips starting to open. Their hips are going to kind of lead their shoulders. It's just going to create more of a stretching effect to increase bat speed.
Right, and that's why you said the Santana's a hinge guy, because if your hips and torso are pretty much in line, how do you get rotation, right?
Right, yeah, it's harder to basically maximize the effect of rotation. He still rotates, but it's harder to maximize the effect of the rotation if you're moving it more as one rather than stretching it like a rubber band.
Gotcha.
Another thing, his wrists roll over pretty quickly after contact. I think that part of that's just direction, and I think that's basically based in the hands and the wrists getting kind of overused to try and create backspeed. He's kind of the type of hitter I call a grip and a rip type guy, where he's just getting up there, he's going to white knuckle the bat, and he's just going to try and, you know, pound his way through it without maybe sequencing properly.
Right.
If I can make any recommendations to Domingo, it would probably be to land his front foot open a little bit more than he does, to start his hip rotation a little bit. I think that would help his sequencing a lot, get his hips out a little bit earlier, and be able to just put him on plane a little bit earlier. Guys that are able to open up and basically clear their hips, you actually create space for your back arm to work through and create more, basically a wider hitting zone. And I think that'll help him reduce his strikeouts, get himself on plane, because he has elite exit velos. There's no strength problem here. I think we just need to get him to hit more balls in the air, and so the exit velos are going out for home runs and doubles rather than, you know. I was watched into a Twins game where they played the Brewers that actually got rained out, and first ball Domingo hits of the game is 107 miles an hour because they have an exit velo thing at Target Field. And it's a hard ground ball between second and first baseman for a base hit to right. And I'm like, but what if we can take that and we can just lift it up?
Just harness it a little bit better. Yeah.
And just basically utilize it a little
bit
better.
Right, right.
There's no strength problem. The tools are there. There's a reason that scouts, you know, were big on Domingo's tools. And the biggest thing is just basically getting the contact and the swing in a place where he's going to be able to be really successful. It's hard to see a great hitter right now with his hitting zone being kind of narrow. He can certainly be a hot and cold type guy who hits, you know, 240 and hits 25 home runs, and then it's down to how much he walks. But I think he could be a really good hitter if he just extends his hitting zone, gets his hips going ahead of his torso a little bit more. And these are very small adjustments he has to make. They're not overhaul. Like, this isn't a guy with a terrible swing. This is a guy that has the foundation for what can be a really good swing. And if they can make some just minor tweaks to it, I mean, he physically is just a monster. And so,
wait, I have one more swing question. Giancarlo Stanton, he's one of my favorite hitters to watch.
Yep.
And obviously he's also a big dude, you know, a strong dude, but it just seems like he knows how to utilize that strength really well.
Yep, he's a guy, he's a pretty simple swing too. Most bigger guys are simple or more simple swings for a couple of reasons. One, they're just big, so they don't need to utilize their entire body necessarily to just mash the ball because they're so strong. But also because bigger guys are usually going to be a little less coordinated just because they're moving so much more stuff. But Stanton, he's a guy that's going to get on plane. He's actually a relatively flat swinger for a guy that is as big as he is and as powerful as he is. Notice he'll hit a lot of those just missiles that just clear the wall.
Yeah.
The Ricky Weeks special, basically. and then, of course, he'll hit the towering bombs and stuff. But
he doesn't have, like, an uppercut or anything.
No, not
like chart grid. Yeah.
No, you wouldn't call him, like, 2015 Chris Bryant.
Right.
He's pretty flat. Now, obviously, you got a guy with that kind of strength and stuff. He just, like, whatever you have to do to make contact and drive the ball on a line,
right, just
do that, because you're so strong. You can hit line drives that are normally like, you know, doubles, you know, two hoppers at the wall, and he's just so strong, he's just going to drive them out. So
gotcha.
There's certain things. I mean, guys at the edges of the extremes, you do different things with.
All right. Well, this was that's a very long episode, but very, very informative. Ryan, Connor, thanks so much for coming on, man.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.